Today in Studio 360, the director Alfonso Cuarón, who doesn't think of his movies as his beloved children, more like ex-wives.
They gave me so much, I gave them so much, we love each other so much, but now we parted ways, we don't see each other.
The latest ex-Mrs. Cuarón, Gravity, starring George Clooney and Sandra Bullock, a movie that is built like the most awesome and artistic roller coaster ever.
Do you copy?
Yes, I copy, I'm detached.
And the latest in our series on American icons, the original Selfies, Cindy Sherman's untitled film stills.
The selfie's not about who you really are. It's about creating this narrative of what you're doing and how great that seems. And that's what the work is about, manufactured identities.
Plus, the singer-songwriter Bill Callahan.
Like a widow with a rosary.
I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and more is ahead this hour in Studio 360, right after this. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. So, a picture's worth a thousand words, but a Cindy Sherman picture's worth an entire imaginary screenplay.
They don't show the climax of the movie or the most, you know, important scene. That blankness is a kind of stand-in for whatever you as the viewer want to believe about that character.
The woman's, like, cheating husband has driven a car off the pier that she had rigged.
Cindy Sherman's untitled film stills are next in our series American Icons, later this hour.
Ever since I put your picture, you're free.
But first, in the Arab world, poetry is everywhere, still very much alive and kicking. School kids memorize 9th century Arabic epics, regular people quote 19th century poems, and especially lately, angry citizens complain in verse. In Syria, over the last 2.5 years, as anti-government demonstrations became an uprising, became a civil war, the poetry has flowed freely. And it's changed. That's according to my next guest, Hrada Alatrush. Hrada grew up in Syria, but for the last 25 years, she's lived in the U.S. and now Canada, where she teaches, writes, and translates. Hrada Alatrush, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having me.
So at demonstrations like that one we just heard and that I've watched on YouTube, Syrians are chanting poetry in unison. It's like a mosh pit or some incredibly fervent political rally. As a Syrian and a scholar of Syrian poetry, does this surprise you?
The Syrian revolution has for sure given birth to new voices when it comes to poetry. The wall of fear has fallen and people are writing and saying things that would have not been said a few years ago. So it does not surprise me that poetry is being used as a tool, perhaps in a different manner than before. Poetry has always been sung by younger and older generations, and this can be all across.
And sung, a given poem has a given melody?
Yes.
And why do we call them poems then instead of songs?
Because they're written by poets. They're written by figures who are considered icons, and the poem is recited from beginning to end while it's being sung to music.
Uh-huh. And you have discovered a few poets through social media. One of them is Najat Abdul Samad. Tell us about her.
She's an OBGYN physician, but she's also a novelist and a poet from Sweida, my hometown in Syria. And she has actually been very outspoken in what sides she's taken. And she's not afraid to speak. And I could share this poem with you if you'd
like. I would
like.
Love to hear it. Yes, please.
Okay. So I'll start with the Arabic, okay, and then I'll go into my English translation. وإن ألم بضعف أعصب قلبي بصبر النساء على المحن أعصبه بقمات نساء سورية التي منحنت من ثكل ومن فقر ومن تهجير هبت When I am overcome with weakness I bandage my heart with a woman's patience in adversity I bandage it with the upright posture of a Syrian woman who is not bent by bereavement, poverty, or displacement as she rises from the banquets of death and carries on shepherding life's rituals. She does not cut a tree, does not steal, does not surrender her soul to weariness, does not ask anyone's charity, does not fold with the load, and does not yield midway. I bandage my heart with the determination of that boy they hit with an electric stick on his only kidney until he urinated blood, yet he returned and walked in the next demonstration. I bandage it with the steadiness of a child's steps in the snow of a refugee camp, a child wearing a small black shoe on one foot and a large blue sandal on the other, wandering off and singing to butterflies flying in the sunny skies, butterflies and skies seen only by his eyes. I bandage it with December's frozen tree roots, trees that have sworn to blossom in March or April. I bandage it with the voice of reason that was not affected by a proximate desolation. I bandage it with veins whose warm blood has not yet been spilt on the surface of our sacred soil. I bandage it with what was entrusted by our martyrs, with the conscience of the living, and with the image of a beautiful homeland envisioned by the eyes of the poor. I bandage it with the outcry, death and not humiliation.
And that is Harada Alatrush reading her translation of a new poem out of Syria by the poet Najat Abdul Samad. Did you talk to any of these poets whose work you've translated about whether they fear the consequences of what they're writing?
Yes, and the opinions differ. Some really are beyond fear, and they will write whatever. But there are others who have specifically asked me to be careful of where these are published, because they do fear you know, the lives and the consequences on their children. And yes, certainly, but it was much worse before. Now it's only progressing, and people are only shedding that fear.
And are poems coming out of literally all sides, poems celebrating the regime, poems celebrating the more secular part of the opposition, poems celebrating the more Islamist side of the opposition? Do each of these realms and sub-realms have their own poets?
Well, sure, yes. You know, Syrians are divided at this stage. There are those who, you know, wish that the regime had stayed versus what is happening today. And I think that represents many Syrians today. And it represents also me. I've never been a supporter of the regime, but what's happening today is by no means what Syrians have wanted. Each is worse than the other. But regardless, yes, there is different of opinions, a different of expressions, and quite a bit of polarity on both sides. And that also brings polarity in opinion and expression.
Harada Alatrush, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
At studio360.org, you can find and read the poem you heard today by Najat Abdul Samad, as well as another new poem from the Syrian front lines. The new Sandra Bullock, George Clooney space movie, Gravity, really is unlike anything I've ever seen. There are these incredible long shots that capture amazing action, and that action isn't as crazy and outsized and maximal as other special effects blockbusters, but it packs way more punch.
Houston, this is Mission Specialist Ryan Stone. I am off structure and I'm drifting. Do you copy? Anyone?
Gravity was directed and co-written by Alfonso Cuarón, who previously made A Little Princess, Y Tu Mamá También, one of the Harry Potter movies, and Children of Men, which means he is a guy who does not repeat himself. Alfonso Cuarón, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt.
The action in Gravity is relentless, and these space panoramas are amazing. But What's interesting is, as a film, it's sort of small and austere. And there are no cuts to Earth in Mission Control. You almost don't see Earth during the film. Just a couple of people alone in space with this simple story. Was that the notion from the beginning?
Yeah, no, that was the idea was that it's almost a metaphorical journey. Outer space is a metaphor of the inner space of our character. So in that sense, there's a certain intimacy about the whole thing. As Jonas Cuarón, my co-writer, kept on saying, in one hand has to do this roller coaster.
Who is a relative of yours, by the way.
Yeah, he's my son. Yeah, little detail. It has to be a roller coaster of a ride filled with suspense and tension. But by the same token, it has to be this emotional journey. One has to inform the other. We cannot be stopping to have now our dramatic moment and then cut to the chase, but everything has to be all together and organic. We defined that the thematic of the film was about adversities. Adversities takes you out of your comfort zone, tend to make you drift, and you can start drifting into the void, not unlike our character. So it was through this process that we were planning this journey, that this roller coaster ride, that all that thematic element is expressed through visual metaphors.
So when you start off with this story in which the actors are going to be floating in space the whole time, something that has never been filmed for a whole movie before, how long did you think it would take to get it made?
I always say that it was a miscalculation. I finished the screenplay and I thought it was going to be something very straightforward with a fair amount of visual effects. And it was not until we start kind of grounding the screenplay into how we're going to do it that we realized that the technology didn't exist to make the film we wanted to make. A long journey of invention and research began.
And as you were going through that process, did you and your partners ever think about giving up?
It was a whole journey of discovery. So you just keep on learning and failing and having great finds. And so it was a process of exhilaration and frustration.
With practically every big movie now loaded with visual effects, it's kind of hard to amaze audiences. But in Gravity, you do it straight out of the box. The first shot is almost a quarter hour long. Was that always the intention, open the movie with one super long continuous shot?
Well, that was the suggestion already from the screenplay. And the goal of that first shot was first to observe everything objectively, the way that you would observe an IMAX documentary. And then you see a routine mission with some astronauts doing some work.
And just doing small talk as they do.
Small talk and stuff. And eventually the camera, when disaster strikes, our character starts running away into the void. The camera keeps on following this character objectively until there's a point in which the camera finally locks with the character. And now the camera is rolling together with the character.
Right.
Eventually, the camera goes into the POV of the character. And the whole theory is that once that we come out of that POV, the camera is not objective, is not subjective. The camera is the POV of the audience. So we have now the audience journeying in space with the other astronauts. And I'm happy people talk about the long shot deals and stuff, but for me that's a little irrelevant. It's not a look, mama, no hands kind of shot. You know, every shot has its meaning and its purpose. This film would be a completely shallow if it was not for the biggest visual effect here, that is the performance of Sandra Bullock.
In order to pull off this visual trick of actors looking as though they're floating in zero gravity the whole time, you had to film them in these extremely controlled contraptions with actors on wires and mechanical rigs and computer-controlled lights everywhere. Did Sandra Bullock and George Clooney have any flexibility to act?
Well, the big challenge for the actors was that everything was pre-programmed. Pre-programmed robots that were carrying the camera and the lights, and the pre-programmed rigs for the actors that they were actually very straining for them. And the room for change was minimum.
So they were just extras in the robot picture?
Well, not, it's the opposite, because the important thing here was more like a ballet, in which the actors, they have to memorize a very precise choreography, It was an exercise about abstraction because they were performing against nothing. So the beauty of that is that they rehearsed so much that when we were in the set, everything was just about performance. Again, like a dancer that when he's finally on stage, all of that hard work is secondhand to the expression.
It's also, naturally, this film in 3D, and it's maybe the first film I've seen since Avatar where I thought, like, this used 3D in a fantastic way. Also, the sound is a very 3D experience. I want to play a clip where things start going bad and this storm of dead satellites is hurtling toward the characters and their shuttle.
From a BSE sat. Repeat. I have
Dr. Stone requesting faster transport.
We have to go. We have to go, go, go.
Kennedy reports meteorological conditions. Don't go.
Houston, Explorer, copy.
Explorer, Dr. Stone requesting faster transport to Bay Area. Explorer, do you copy?
Explorer, permission to retrieve Dr. Stone.
Here goes one. Houston, Explorer, copy.
All right.
We've lost Houston.
Look, we need to get the hell out of here.
Need some help there, man.
No, don't wait for us.
We're stuck.
Man down.
That was George Clooney and Sandra Bullock dealing with space chaos in Gravity. How did you approach making a sound-rich movie in, of course, what is absolutely silent space?
Well, the actual sound effects, we were very literal about following the rules of physics, that there's no sound in space. You can hear whenever there's an interaction between our character and objects, because the vibrations would travel to the ear and the brain. But then we use music. There was this German composer called Stockhausen. And Stockhausen had these pieces in which audiences were in the hall, but the orchestra was not on stage. It was scattered around the hall. And when the music started, they start playing, but then they start moving around. And it would create these dynamics. And that's what we tried to reproduce with the surround sound.
You could afford to take up one of Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic flights next year when they start. Will you do that?
If your station sponsors me, I'll be so happy. We can do a direct link when I'm up
really?
There.
We can start a Kickstarter get the 250 grand?
Exactly, yeah.
Well, let's talk about that. When people talk about your films, they mention, you say, there are all of these long, slow, real-time tracking shots in Y Tu Mamá También, in Children of Men, now in this. Did you start doing that partly as a reaction to what was happening in the 80s as you were growing up and this quick cut thing became the way movies are the new cinematic language?
I enjoy montage. I enjoy editing. I don't have a riff with that. I have a riff against point of view. It's just a lot of footage put together and trying to create certain energy and stuff with a lot of cuts.
And they're just cutting the music or whatever.
Yes, and that bothers me quite a lot. Another thing that I've been exploring with Lubezki, the director of photography for many films now, is this tension between character and context and environment. So character and environment, they have the same weight. You know, so that's the reason I don't favor close-up that much.
One of the movies you made before everybody knew who you were and you were a big famous movie director was A Little Princess, based on the novel by Frances Hodgson Burnett. I want to play a short clip from it in which the main character is defending her imagination and princesshood.
I am a princess. All girls are. Even if they live in tiny old attics, even if they dress in rags, even if they aren't pretty or smart or young, they're still princesses. All of us. Didn't your father ever tell you that? Didn't he?
That was from A Little Princess, 1995. A lot of people, including my daughters, still love that film. And I read that it's your favorite of all your films?
Ever since I finished my films, I never see them again.
I read that too, which is interesting.
But this one is, I just have a very good memory out of it and the energy of that film.
And I also read that unlike authors who say, consider every novel their baby or filmmakers, every movie is my child, not you. You say that they're like your ex-wife.
Yeah. They gave me so much. I gave them so much. We love each other so much, but now we parted ways. We don't see each other. if my ex-wife is in trouble, obviously I would go immediately.
So they weren't acrimonious divorces.
You know, no. It's just the same here. If it's only, you know, that my negative is going to be burned, yeah, I try to go and rescue it.
So you've done the Princess movie, the adaptation of a classic, the coming-of-age movie, the franchise installment, the dystopian sci-fi film, now this visual effects spectacular. Do you have like a genre checklist and you just check, next one?
No, that would be helpful because it's one of those things you just do what you think is the right thing to do.
And what's the right next thing? And will it be once more something unlike what you've done before?
Probably. I never thought, it's because I don't really revisit my films, so I don't really know much about what they have in common or not.
Well, I can remind you what you've done before if you want.
No, please don't.
Alfonso Cuarón, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you, Kurt. Thank you very much. It was fun.
Alfonso Cuarón made the movie Gravity, which is open everywhere. Coming up next, a set of images that broke all the rules for fine art photography.
I think what's brilliant about the Untitled Film Stills and about Cindy's work in general is you don't need a PhD in order to get them. And accessibility here is not a bad word.
Cindy Sherman's Untitled Film Stills, our latest American icon, next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity. Lumosity.com daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Until cable came along, late night TV was all about old Hollywood movies.
Night, kids.
Between the end of the Johnny Carson show and the national anthem sign-off, we used to gorge on a smorgasbord of B-movies and studio classics. The photographer Cindy Sherman had the same experience as a kid in the 1970s. In an introduction to a book of her work, she wrote about going to a dinner party with her parents and watching Hitchcock's Rear Window alone in the basement. For most of us, those kinds of sleepy glimpses of the cinematic past just sank into oblivion. But not for Cindy Sherman. About 30 years ago, she turned all those movie memories into a series of self-portraits that have a weirdly haunting power. For our series of American Icons, producer Ann Hepperman takes a closer look at Sherman's series, Untitled Film Stills.
Cindy Sherman's Untitled Film Stills just feel familiar. Like Untitled Film Still number 21.
People often call it the City Girl.
Which I'm looking at right now with Museum of Modern Art curator Eva Ruspini.
No, here it is. Yeah.
It's a black and white 8x10 photo. And in it, you see a young woman surrounded by big city office towers.
There's no question that she's in Manhattan. Here she is.
And she's dressed like a 1950s fresh off the bus career girl from Kansas.
She's got her, hat and her little suit on and she's, trying to get a job.
The picture's shot from below, with Sherman's face front and center. But what you really notice are her eyes.
Her expression seems kind of fearful, maybe a little bit lonely.
They're looking at something or someone just outside the frame.
But this, to me, implies that someone's maybe watching her. You just know at the end of the film that she's going to die, that there's something foreboding. There's this Hitchcockian, violence that's kind of lurking underneath. That's definitely the film, taking over.
Cindy Sherman has somehow created an entire movie around what looks like one frame of film. 70 different images make up the Untitled Film Stills. And they're meant to look cheap, like photos you'd find in a thrift store. Sherman changes her hair and her outfits to act out a whole range of 1950s and 60s B-movie and art house cliches, like the career girl.
I think this application is filled out all right, Mr. Arnold.
Thank you.
The bombshell.
I have to live as if every day were my last one. Something powerful in me that makes me behave foolishly.
And the housewife.
Like so many people these days, we live in the suburbs.
Cindy Sherman started making the untitled film stills in 1977. At first, she'd dress up, rearrange the furniture, and shoot photos of herself. This was in the Soho loft that she shared with her then-boyfriend and fellow artist, Robert Longo.
And then she had this idea about wanting to go out.
She'd stuff a suitcase with clothes and wigs and throw them in the back of their van.
It was like a hippie van. And we'd drive to locations and she would change in the back and then come out of the van a different character. It would always be quite hideous sometimes. She looked pretty weird sometimes.
When she worked outside, Sherman often had family or friends snap the pictures. Helene Weiner owned the Artist Space Gallery where Cindy Sherman worked. She shot untitled film still number 83. Sherman told Weiner, "Stand over there and take some pictures as I walk down the street."
I thought, oh, these are going to be the worst ones, the most terrible ones, because she's not doing anything.
What came out, though, looks like a shot from some European movie.
You know, a Italian movie star fleeing from the press or not wanting to be recognized.
Sherman's wearing a black wig and sunglasses cover her face, and she seems to be rushing across the square. Her expressions are subtle, but evocative. Unlike real film stills, Sherman did not go for the over-the-top look. MoMA's Eva Ruspini.
They would actually fail completely as actual publicity stills in that they don't show the climax of the movie or the most, you know, important scene, or they don't convey the narrative in the way that publicity stills were set up to do, and that blankness is a kind of stand-in for whatever you as the viewer want to believe about that character.
The woman's, like, cheating husband has driven a car off the pier that she had rigged.
Oh, I loved those. It looked so like Berlin in some spy novel.
The moment where I picture her shifting from feeling sorry for herself to, you know what, I am going to get out of here now.
Sherman brought some of the untitled film stills into the Artist Space Gallery, where she worked as a part-time receptionist.
We went crazy over them. I mean, I'm sure if the janitor was standing there, he would have known that this was something very, very special.
The untitled film stills didn't linger as some wallflower art project. Everyone loved them.
Collectors had never bought a photograph and would not buy it. Cindy was the only one people would actually purchase to own.
Critics loved the series, too. As one person put it, it seemed like you'd come upon the film stills in books, anthologies, and magazines more often than in a gallery or a museum.
Cindy Sherman, Untitled Film Stills, is known to every single art student.
That's Zoe Crosher. She's a contemporary artist in Los Angeles. I found her after Googling, "Untitled Film Stills Changed My Life."
It's slightly disconcerting because I said that in some offhand remark during some talk that I gave somewhere. But it did change my life.
Crosher remembers exactly how that influence worked on her. She was 19 and in college when she first saw the untitled film stills. She'd been struggling to find an artist who inspired her, especially a woman. There were women photographers, yes, but all their work was documentary. Grab a camera, go out into the world, and capture all the freaks that you can see. Then she saw the untitled film stills.
Suddenly here comes this complicated situation where I'm looking at something that's constructed, but it doesn't look like it's constructed. And this woman who's chameleon-like and changing the way that she presents herself. And she's also in control of the taking of all of these photographs and this notion of agency that she, it sounds like she probably didn't even intend to have, which is one of the interesting things about her and the history of her work is that she's mute about everything she does.
And that's part of the mystery of Cindy Sherman. Even though she puts herself center stage in the images, she's extremely private. The artist was gracious about it, but eventually declined to talk for the story. And for a lot of people, Sherman's silence just adds to the layers of ambiguity in the untitled film stills.
Would I like to have a conversation with her? Of course, but that's not important. Understanding her intent with this, like, that's completely not important. What's important is what I've decided is important about it to me.
Jim Adkins is the lead singer of Jimmy Eat World. And a few years ago, he started using the untitled film stills as a writing exercise. And then it turned into an album, Invented.
I can't compete with the clear eyes of strangers.
Adkins says his backstories for the untitled film stills got quite elaborate. Like untitled film still number 36. That turned into a song called Evidence.
Follow you around till it's time to leave.
In the photo, Sherman is just a silhouette of a woman. She's changing clothes. It looks like lingerie. And there's a cloth hanging right behind her.
Maybe she moved into a place with a boyfriend and they got like a super awesome deal on a really small place in New York. You know, they break up, but neither of them really want to move out because they have such an awesome deal on this rent-controlled space. Just to get some sort of privacy, she just staples this bedsheet to the ceiling in between their space. And the dude, you know, has no choice but to kind of, you know, stew in this tension.
I think what's brilliant about the Untitled Film Stills and about Cindy's work in general is you don't need a PhD in order to get them. And I think the work is smart, perceptive, elegant, provocative, but accessible. And accessibility here is not a bad word.
And because they're so accessible, so easy to grab onto, the Untitled Film Stills stories become our narratives. It's like there's some kind of art Rorschach test. The stories we tell about them reveal something about us. Even more so now, says Eva Ruspini, when so many of us are constructing stories with photographs.
You know, all of those things are about facades. The selfie's not about who you really are. It's about how you look best in the camera to your friends, creating this, you know, narrative of what you're doing and how great that seems.
I love you too.
Getting married.
Is that your sissy?
Yeah.
And that's what the work is about. It's really about manufactured identities.
And who knows how we'll be feeling in 30 plus years about our own selfies. Truthfully, I'm a little sick of these pictures. Cindy Sherman wrote in 1997, when MoMA displayed the Untitled Film Stills together for the first time, "It's funny to see some of them now. Funny, because while people have been generating mental movies from the Untitled Film Stills, Sherman looks at them and sees this. Herself on a certain day, decades ago, dressed a certain way, acting out a certain scenario. She isn't the person in the Untitled Film Stills anymore. That person is us." For Studio 360, I'm Ann Hepperman.
You can see a slideshow of Cindy Sherman's Untitled Film Stills at our website, studio360.org. We've still got a few more American icons coming to you this season, and we want you to pick the final one. We're keeping track of all your submissions, from Soul Train to Purple Rain to All in the Family, which was submitted by Nancy Gentile of Queens, New York.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played.
You just don't think of it as a sitcom, because we think of a sitcom as really silly, but they were really dealing with the issues that American society was dealing with at that time.
They're paying me less than they paid the man who used to run the forklift.
Oh, well, come on, Irene. After all, it's a well-known fact. Men are worth more than women.
Have you been reading Playboy?
No, Irene, the Bible. And in the Bible, it says God made man his own image. He made women after, from a rib, cheaper cut.
Most sitcoms that we knew, father always went to work and the mother was home and he was a professional and everyone was well-educated and well-groomed. The Bunkers were not that. They didn't have perfect grammar. They were middle-class, not highly educated. The characters were just so real.
There is still time to nominate your American icon. What book or album or movie or building gets your vote as a quintessential piece of Americana? Visit studio360.org/American Icons and drop a pin on our culture map. Still ahead on this hour of Studio 360, the lo-fi rocker Bill Callahan has been putting out albums since 1990, and they just keep getting better.
Well, the only words I said today are beer and thank you.
I'll talk with Bill Callahan, and he'll perform some music. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Beer.
Stay with us.
Thank you.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity. Lumosity.com daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
All aboard!
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I want to say hello to our new listeners in the Erie, Pennsylvania area. Listening on WQLN. Welcome. WQLN. 2013 is speeding to a close, and a few of our listeners are really feeling it. Those few who made creative New Year's resolutions that we are monitoring. By the end of the year, Michael Relland is going to play a cello recital. Charlie Kapp is going to finish his graphic novel, and Linda Brewer in Tucson will have written a short story every month of the year. She's done a great job of meeting her deadline so far, all while working her regular 9-to-5 job. Linda usually thinks of story ideas while she's running through the park across the street from her house. So we paid a visit on one of those runs and tried to keep up.
When I'm running, I can't say I really think about it, but I just sort of mull it over, and then I get some ideas. I always get some ideas. Maybe it's just the rhythm of forward movement, but usually by the time I'm done, I come back and I can scribble a couple post-it notes. And then I get to work. Okay, that's pretty good. It's pretty good for September 30th. When I first came here from the Pacific Northwest, I found this landscape extremely bleak. And every person I talked to said, the desert has a beauty all its own. And I would always think, that's hogwash. But I like the phrase, and I think that it might work with the plot of my story. The desert has a beauty all its own. Red kings and black queens bounced across the road in front of the bus. Roger cried, "Look out!" But it was only a hallucination, and the driver didn't seem to have heard him. This other picture is my inspiration. This is a newspaper picture taken 2 days after Hurricane Katrina, and it shows an evacuation center in a gym or someplace like that with all these people on cots. And the reason I love this picture is that there's a teenage girl sitting over here on her cot, and she is writing. And I think, if that girl could sit there amid all this chaos and write down her thoughts, then I can do that in my tame little life that, you know, didn't get blown away by a hurricane. When the bus reached Main Street, he pulled the cord and got off at the corner. A hot wind was blowing, and he remembered that in Tucson, a breeze could be hotter than still air. He cut across a vacant lot that had had a garage on it 3 years ago. He remembered cream-colored brick with faded blue trim, sounds of work coming from inside. Romero's it had been. Now there was nothing but an acre of dust with a few dry weeds around the edges, not even a stray tire left behind. He turned right onto Hirasol Street, all 3 blocks of it, and there was his parents' house. A couple stood on the sidewalk in front of the gate, 2 people casting 1 shifting shadow. A rooster crowed nearby in spite of the growing darkness. Roger suddenly wondered if his father had moved without letting him know. He walked up to the couple and said, "Do the Forbeses still live here?" I told somebody I'd rather slit my throat than miss that deadline. It's just, you make the resolution and you say it in public, you've just got to do it. There's no getting out of it.
You can read Linda's latest story, The Desert Has a Beauty All Its Own, at studio360.org, where you'll find all the other stories she's written this year, plus updates from our other creative resolution makers. Feel free to leave a comment, support, advice, whatever you want. As a young man in 1990, Bill Callahan started making music under the name Smog. It was experimental and extremely spare, just Callahan playing guitar riffs with a bit of production here and there. But at the center of it all was Callahan's baritone voice and his Spartan lyrics. This is The Hard Road from 2000.
I'll take the hard road. I believe I'll see you there. In a cyclone of stones, wooden spikes in your hair.
After 13 albums, Callahan dropped the stage name Smog and started making music under his real name, music that critics said was his best yet. His new album is called Dream River, and he joins me now in Studio 360. Bill Callahan, welcome.
Thank you.
So although this album features a full band, you're here today with only your electric guitar. Can we begin with a song from Dream River?
Yeah.
What's this going to be?
I'm going to do The Sing. Drinking while sleeping, strangers unknowingly keep me company in the hotel bar. Looking out a window that isn't there. Looking at the carpet and the chairs. Well, the only words I've said today are beer. And thank you. Like Marvin Gaye, Mortal Joy. Is that way? Song to a long, long train, long, long gone, then silence comes back alone. Highest scaffold ding. Wind finds something to ping, or the pinging thing finds the wind.
We're all looking for a body or a means to make one sing.
That was Bill Callahan performing The Sing from his new album Dream River. Good art always or often seems to be about some particular time and place. Do you have a sense with Dream River of either imaginary or real where this zone is that you're writing about?
I was trying to make a record to listen to before you go to bed, something that wasn't too jarring or upsetting, something that would kind of leave you with peaceful feeling. I forget what was your actual question.
Is there a kind of time and place that you're trying to evoke or
I think
conjure?
It's like just a dream time, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And Dream River and sort of all the mystical rivers like the Ganges and just that type of feel.
You've said that when you write, you write lyrics first and then figure out the music and sing them later. Why does that process, that order, work for you?
It's the only way I seem to be able to do it. I need to make a story, and I don't want to use the music as any kind of a crutch at any point. So the only way to be true to myself is for the lyrics to stand up on their own. And then it becomes a very desperate, because setting it to music is very hard for me, because I'm not much of a musician. I'm not very flexible or fluid a musician. So it's a long process. So I want to
get the thing that you can get right first?
Yeah, and then I can just focus like a drill on a block of stone, you know, without thinking about the words at all. I can just then do the next task.
So block of stone. So you've also called it wood carving. Is that how it feels? Is just chipping away?
Yeah, I mean, I think of it like that, just because if you could play all the options of sounds music can make, it would just sound like white noise, you know, a block of noise. And then I always feel like I'm just chipping away at that to find the melody.
May we hear another song?
Yeah. This is called Spring. The wind is pushing the clouds along. Out of sight, a power is putting them away. A power that moves things neurotically, like a widow with a rosary. Everything is awing and tired of praise, and mountains don't need my accolades, and spring looks bad lately anyway, like death warmed over. Bantam is preening madly, waiting for the light of day. And all I want to do is to make love to you.
mind, with a careless mind, with a careless, careless, careless mind.
That's Bill Callahan playing Spring from his new album Dream River. And you can hear the full version of that song at studio360.org, where you can also see a video of his performance here. We are done with this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Lital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel, Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramaswaram,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Julie Dorio,
Dylan Piers McCoy,
Felicity Sheehy.
Special thanks to KJZZ's Michelle Marzico in Tucson. Normal thanks to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum. And don't forget to nominate your American icon at studio360.org/American Icons.
Studio 360 is supported by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, Artworks. Studio 360's American Icons project is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Great Ideas Brought to Life.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
I believe we do things that really are magic and defy explanation.
We're going someplace magical.
I always thought Disneyland is like going to heaven.
We're going to Disney World!
When you wish upon a star...
The Disney theme parks. Next time in Studio 360's American Icons from PRI and WNYC.